Richard Murdoch challenges Dick Lugar. Does Lugar have a residency problem? Wayne Siebold for Congress. The death of the creationism bill and the departure of some longtime lawmakers. That plus the Manning-Ursay drama and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 17,
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Richard Murdoch charged that Richard Lugar fails to meet a constitutional requirement to be reelected to the U.S. Senate. Murdoch held a news conference in front of the home Lugar sold in 1977, his last Indiana residence. Lugar now lives in Virginia and stays in hotels when he returns to Indiana. The Lugar campaign has rejected challenges to his residency, citing an opinion from the Attorney General. But Murdoch has made a new challenge.
Take that issue off the table, Mr. Lugar. Find a residence in Indiana, and again, make it perfectly clear, be totally transparent, that you are, in fact, an inhabitant.
Will Dick Lugar establish an Indiana residence? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Leslie Weidenbender, editor at thestatehousefile.com. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, Democrats raised questions about Lugar's residency last week. Now Murdoch is this collusion?
No, actually, it's kind of fun for Democrats because, you know, the Republicans litigated that question unsuccessfully a few years ago, as you recall. So it's kind of nice to see the, you know, the worm turn. But in reality, he does not have a legal problem with his residency. But he does have a perception problem because, you know, it reinforces the notion that he's been in Washington for better than three decades and is out of touch. And the fact that he bills the taxpayers for the hotel stays when he comes back, I think presents an additional problem for him.
Not all of them, as I understand it. The campaign pays for some of them.
How do you decide?
When you do campaign events.
Okay, but if you're coming back for official events, it shouldn't be on the taxpayers' dime if you don't have a residence here either, I don't think. And I think that presents a perception problem, but not a legal problem.
All right, I don't think he has a legal problem either, but Richard Murdoch is suggesting that he does, and Tea Party supporters of Richard Murdoch are posing the question everywhere on the internet that they can, why isn't he prosecuted the way Charlie White was?
This is a silly season kind of thing. I think they're grasping at straws. In fact, I think it's a flawed strategy, and the reason I say that is a recent survey that the Lugar camp did, but same pollster that which I find entertaining, the same pollster used by the Club for Growth, so the very people that are going to challenge them, they use the same pollster, so it's hard to challenge their numbers when they're using the same operation. But anyway, they show a 55-30 advantage for Senator Lugar, but with seniors, that shoots up an additional 9 points to 64. And seniors are the biggest part of the voting population in the Republican primary. So they may be making a huge mistake by, in essence, insulting a seasoned citizen like Dick Lugar, who has all this experience, because those are the people that vote.
Well, does that mean old?
Let me help you. He's 79. Make up your own mind.
I mean, come on. Look, he got all of this experience. He served his country his entire life. There's no question about his residency, no legal challenge here. So they're trying to score political points. It's not going to work. In fact, I think it's going to backfire.
But you got to believe that Lugar and his supporters are a little uncomfortable, or they wouldn't be leaking an internal poll in February.
Well, they may be a little uncomfortable. I mean, I'll agree with what everybody has said. There's no legal problem. It's been litigated to the nth degree, and we can take that off the table right now. And clearly, to your point, Jim, about the Tea Party calling for an investigation by the State Election Commission, I think the governor effectively took that off the table by saying he wasn't going to, or at least was not
He said, what happened was a Tea Party group took some petitions to the governor and said that the governor should force the Election Commission to address this question. He won't do it, but I think the Election Commission may actually address this, right?
They can. They can take it up if they want, and they might still do that. I don't think that there's going to be an issue. What I think is interesting...
Would that take it off the table?
No. No, because this is part of a case that Democrats and Murdoch are trying to make that Senator Lugar is out of touch. I do think it's interesting that that Richard Murdoch decided to go make this appearance himself rather than letting this play out beneath him. And instead, I just wonder if Richard Murdoch wants voters to make a decision about Senator Lugar based on where his home is, or if they want him to make decisions based on the issues.
I do think it's the notion of perception, as has been said. And it's kind of the issue that keeps on giving, even if there's no legal validity to it. And it reminds me in some ways of what Greg Walker did, now state senator, when he defeated Bob Garton, Senate President Pro Tem, a few years back. And he had, you know, a car, I forget what model car it was, that was produced the same year as Bob Garton took office. And so he'd take that to all his campaign stops. Now, in that case, it wasn't about residency. It was about the long tenure of somebody in a powerful position in office and the suggestion that he was out of touch. Again, somewhat apples to oranges, but still, I think it's the kind of issue that potentially could resonate
I think it can resonate.
I want you to address the point Leslie brought up, because one of the things that Democrats in this state have done, and actually the Republicans as well, is that they let a state chairman or somebody else carry the negative and let the candidate carry the positive.
Yeah.
And the Murdoch campaign's already doing negative ads, and there hasn't been much positive there.
No, there hasn't been, in answer to the observation that Leslie made. I think it's very difficult to convince people that Richard Lugar isn't a Hoosier. Okay, I mean, I think he is. The question whether he's a Hoosier in touch is another question completely. But if Murdoch would be silly enough to actually try to launch a legal challenge, we all know how that plays out, don't we, Michael?
Yeah.
I think it's a reference to the 1988 high residency.
And I don't think voters like that either. I think voters say, look, I can make up my own mind about whether he's in touch or not, but put him on the ballot, and that's pretty hard to argue with.
That's correct. I think what you've got here is an opportunity for Dick Lugar to turn this around and have an opportunity for them to display the service that he's provided the state for as long as he has, everything from serving in the military to serving the state as the United States Senator.
Yeah, but when you get up
there... And believe me, there's a lot of great things that he can point to. And if I were them, I'd be running that spot and just take this off the table completely.
There's a lot you can point to, but when you get up to a half a century of service in a party that lauds term limits,
there's a miscalculation here about people just dismissing people who are older.
I'm not.
And I think that's going to backfire.
But I do think. I think you're right.
It's going to backfire.
I absolutely think you're right. But there does seem to be a feeling in the electorate right now. There does seem to be a mood that people who have been in an office for a long time have been there too long. But I do think it's a risk.
Especially if they're in Washington.
Especially the way they do it. You know, if they do it in a malicious way and they do it with some outside source that really comes in and hammers it, it could really backfire.
But this is still an example that other opponents, other challengers of Dick Lugar haven't, a tool they haven't had. So you go back, for instance, all the way to Jack Wicks, who was the Democratic nominee, who here at WFYI at a statewide debate, I remember back in whatever year that would have been in the late 80s, the whole campaign or theme of that debate performance that evening was if Dick Lugar knew Bloomington as well as he knew Botswana, and if Dick Lugar knew, you know, Lebanon, Indiana as well as he, and it didn't resonate then. The difference, of course, now is
30 years
is,
more.
Is the time, and they also now have this very, you have this very visible sort of example with this 26. House that was sold in
Sacramento. I keep thinking of Ronald Reagan's one-line answer when he turned to Walter Mondale and said, I'm not going to make his youth and inexperience an issue in this campaign.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in connection with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, do you care that Dick Lugar lives in Virginia? Your choices are A, yes, he should live in Indiana, B, no, two homes are not required, or C, I care more about how he votes. Last week's question was, who should be the next Secretary of State? 70% said Vop Oseley, 30% said the governor's choice. To take part in the poll, just go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. When Congressman Dan Burton announced plans to retire, it sparked a rush for the 5th District congressional seat that he now occupies. The field in the GOP primary swelled to 8. The most interesting of the late entries is Marion Mayor Wayne Siebold. Siebold has already received an endorsement from Burton, but he joins a strong field that includes Susan Brooks, John McGough, and David McIntosh, Mike McDaniel. Is the Burton endorsement a plus or a minus for Wayne Siebold?
Actually, I think it's a plus, but I will say that I think this election is a wide-open affair, clearly now, now that the incumbent is no longer running, and you have an upper tier of 4 candidates who are very well-known, who have the ability to raise a lot of money and are good communicators. Then we have 4 relatively newcomers to the process. So you have an 8-person field, because these seats don't open up more than maybe once or twice in an entire lifetime. And this seat being as Republican as it is means it'll stay in our camp at the end of the election. But it is a wide open deal. Now, as far as the endorsement's concerned, Wayne Siebold getting that endorsement may mean that he starts with a base, but he'll build on top of that base because he brings some other people to the process that some of the other folks don't. But Susan Brooks is going to be a very good candidate with a lot of money. And she's going to do a great job. McIntosh has some name ID from running before and being a congressman. And McGough ran well twice before.
There's a big Christian right faction in that district that McIntosh plays into. Mm-hmm. Could he pull that off?
Could McIntosh pull that off? I don't think so. You've got a situation here where, first of all, the district's changed. Okay, so I wouldn't write Scott Reske off if I were you. He's going to run a strong campaign.
But Reske got in this race hoping to face a beaten up and bloody
Certainly.
Dan Burton.
Instead, you have a divisive primary. But right. I've got to say, with all due respect to the mayor of Marion, who I think is a good candidate there, I'm not sure that the Burton endorsement's a real plus here. I mean, it's clear that 70% of the voters didn't want him. And I'm not sure that translates into support going in. But when you've got 7 suits, 7 white guys in suits, which is what you've got in Susan Brooks, I think you've got a pretty formidable candidate there for the Republican nomination.
If you're Wayne Siebold, do you have Dan Burton do TV ads for you?
I don't think so. I have to say no. I do think the endorsement gives him a little push since he got into the race later. I've always been fascinated by Wayne Siebold. I think he's an interesting guy. I think he has he's an Olympic champion. He's done some interesting things in his life, and by all accounts has been a good mayor. I'm sort of fascinated by him. But I do think this is Susan Brooks has a real chance here to run away from this field if she can get enough money and really get going here soon. Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, Jim, I would want a television spot featuring Dan Burton if you could buy it on a cable provider by cable provider market. And by that I mean if you can buy a local access spot in the outlying areas, by that I mean the non-metropolitan Indianapolis areas
right.
of the district.
Grand County.
Quote unquote the old part of the district
right.
where Dan Burton has done
you don't think
fairly
that would be
well.
Replayed in well, Indianapolis?
Then it might be a good move. I wouldn't necessarily buy time on Indianapolis per se for the reasons that we've talked here about it being a dramatically different district from what it was when Dan Burton first went into Congress.
Indiana House Speaker Brian Bosma killed a bill this week that would permit the teaching of creationism. Soon thereafter, there was an education reform rally at the State House. Organizers called the event a celebration of the changes the legislature has made, including the creation of school vouchers. The governor says Indiana has made great strides in making education a priority.
You know, one of the most popular special license plates in our state says kids first. But we have not always practiced that. In our education system, we have not always practiced that. We've spent an awful lot of money on buildings. We've spent money on administration. We've not insisted on a top-quality, proven, effective teacher in every classroom. And we have not offered enough choice to the families of our state. But that is all history. Indiana now is the leading education state of the reform state of this country, and you made that happen.
Leslie Weidenbetter, what would a creationism law do to that reputation?
I think that it would bring the kind of attention that Governor Daniels would not want to Indiana schools. I'm not at all surprised that this bill went away. It had been changed. It wasn't quite what it had started out as. It was much broader. It would have incorporated other religions as well. But I think that probably the governor is relieved. But I do have to say, since you just showed that clip, that the funniest part of that rally was how nobody could talk over the kids. That that they got them so riled up that from there on out they couldn't. Nobody was loud enough to calm them down.
Did we learn this week that you know, if you're pushing for school vouchers and charter schools and all sorts of changes, that when you get up to creationism, that's where the line's drawn?
Well, let's put it this way. The courts, the legal line is much clearer there. If you look at the appropriateness of spending public tax dollars on vouchers, if you want to use the term, that I think is a largely unsettled question. I mean, we're dealing with that right now in Indiana. We've already had one ruling at trial court level, and we'll see that progress. And I think you could find a smattering of opinions across the country that take different positions. When you get into something like creationism, where it has gone to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987 out of Louisiana, which had done something similar.
And the author, Senator Dennis Crude, made the argument that the Supreme Court has changed. So essentially what he was saying was, let's fight this to the Supreme Court. So you're talking about big legal bills.
His suggestion,
right?
Is, I think, that the Supreme Court has evolved.
Right.
Maybe even if he buys evolution on the U.S. Supreme Court, even if not anywhere else. But it's been decided, and I think Brian Bosma recognized that there was no point, because this was the Supreme Court decision was basically smack dab on, in trying to litigate this in a costly manner for the state.
The national media came here to cover some of the right to work battle. There were some national media folks poised to come here for a creationism battle. Is there a lack of an appetite for this sort of controversy the rest of this session?
I don't know that played into it. I think that, I was, for one, was not in favor of this legislation. I think it was unnecessary. But I I've come a long way in the 38 years I've been around the legislature to even more appreciate the fact that we have a citizen legislature and people can bring all kinds of different issues to the table. What a lot of people push off as frivolous or unnecessary, they still have the right to do that here, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think the Flat Earth Society is coming in next.
Well,
then the sun revolves around the earth.
Look,
I don't care if you want to teach
it.
I don't care. I don't care if you want to teach it as part of a comparative religion course. But mandating that, when allowing that to be taught in science, including, by the way, let's not forget that they were including Scientology in this. And it wasn't only Dennis Cruz. It was also Scott Snyder in there. So, advocating that God brought...
I think it was a Democrat who put the Scientology in there.
Yeah, but they voted, they passed it out. Bringing it down to earth and blowing up the enemies with hydrogen bombs. Anyway, the point on this is they couldn't have this. This would be a black eye in terms of recruitment of scientists to Indiana. And there's absolutely no truth to the rumor that if Brian Bosma didn't kill this, they were going to take his Purdue degree back.
Victim of the state fair stage collapse appealed to lawmakers this week for an increase in state compensation. Brad Humphrey, who is now a paraplegic, encouraged lawmakers to find new money for victims. He testified to a state Senate committee that is considering a bill that would double the $5 million in state compensation already paid. As he sat in his wheelchair, Humphrey's testimony was obscured even from some committee members by the rostrum used by others.
I will always need a house, a vehicle, any workplace that is accessible to me and my wheelchair. I know that all that is going to cost a lot of money over the rest of my life.
John Schwanis, will that $5 million fund grow?
Well, we've already seen efforts on the part of other lawmakers to expand it beyond that additional $5 million. In fact, I think one of the most outspoken champions of that was a relative of the person sitting beside me, Ed Delaney, was... suggesting when this legislation was in the House, pushing it to upwards of $21 million. If memory serves. I don't think that's going to happen for a whole host of reasons. I think the fact that you have sort of critical mass surrounding this notion of doubling it from the current cap of $5 million to $10 million in this instance, you seem to have some widespread agreement across political boundaries. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't. I mean, we could probably say these people deserve hundreds of millions of dollars. I can only imagine the suffering that victims and those who are still dealing with some of the tragedy as Mr. Humphrey will through for the rest of his life. So there's no good answer here, but I think it probably will stay with the doubling of the cap.
Well, the $5 million means that for the seven families who lost somebody in this tragedy, they would get to the state cap of $700,000.
That's right. So the $5 million cap that state law puts on a total event meant that individuals, the families of individuals who died, did not get to collect as much as they would have if there had just been one death. So what this does is it brings that level up to where they are fully compensated and eliminates essentially the overall cap. And so that is the reasoning behind the $5 million number.
But I don't know how you justify eliminating $5 million more. When you talk about the medical expenses of the survivors, you know, the idea that the state has an event, invites people to the event, sells tickets to the event, and doesn't safeguard them, and then doesn't compensate them, is just kind of amazing to me.
But then you're getting down to talking about whether it's...
Part of the argument is that there are private entities that are being sued and that there's going to be more money provided.
Yeah, but it's still a state
facility. That you're setting. Right. There's the precedent that you're setting. Are you talking about raising the cap for all future such activities? Or are you talking about
It should be. It's seven. The 30 years old.
That might absolutely be right.
It hasn't been raised in 30 years. If you just did it for cost of living, it would be $21 million.
It's in a bill that has $300, maybe $400 million in it. Some of it that will go to education. Some of it that may go to automatic taxpayer refunds. Is there a choice being made between those things?
No. This is an omnibus bill that Representative Vespic has put forth. He gave an excellent explanation as to why they've increased it to $5 million. I totally expect that will be the amount that passes. I thought it was a good explanation in a committee this week of why he came to that amount. And it'll happen. It's going to happen with the support of even the attorneys that represent a lot of these victims. He stood up and
they're not going to look a gift horse in the
favor.
Mouth.
But even he didn't ask for more than the $5 million, which I thought was interesting that he didn't. And his testimony.
He didn't put a figure on it. He did say that if you look at cost of living from when the cap was created in 1974, it would be more than $20 million.
And so did Jeff Vespic, and so did everybody else in committee, but they got it set at some place, and that's where they set it.
And this just underscores the impact of the tragedy, because if we had had this discussion a year ago before the August event, and you had said there will be Republicans and Democrats alike pushing to raise the liability cap, for many lawmakers, they've been preaching tort reform and probably would have granted state sovereignty in all legal matters where there wouldn't be any liability. I'm guessing some would have favored that. So it just shows you how tragic and how this resonates inside and outside the state house.
All right, here's something you seldom see. The chairman of the Indiana House Ways and Means Committee is not running for re-election. Republican Jeff Vespic is hanging it up after 40 years in the state house, and he's not the only longtime lawmaker saying goodbye. Bill Crawford arrived with Vespic in 1972, and he's joining him on the path to retirement. And Chep Nobis, another Democrat, is leaving after 42 years. And Delaney, what's behind the exodus?
Well, the atmosphere over there is toxic. I mean, with the Tea Party and the right to work and the nastiness of the legislation there, it's not surprising. And I would be surprised if more moderates didn't leave.
Well, but 21 lawmakers are not running for re-election. That's very unusual.
It is unusual. Some of it has to do with the general nature of the way politics is conducted and has been for the better part of a decade. Some of it has to do with new districts where people were paired together or got so much new territory that just decided they didn't want to fight it. But I find it interesting because we're going to lose a lot of institutional knowledge, good people who are specialists in the various subjects, like Bev Gard and environment.
Right.
Nobody knows the environmental issues better than Bev Gard and the entire legislature. She's going to retire. Senator Bray and Judiciary. Yeah. I mean, it goes on. And this institutional knowledge is hard to recoup. And I find it funny that we talk about losing this kind of institutional knowledge with all of these veterans on one side, but yet we're attacking Dick Luker for being there a long time.
That is
you're the one who's talking about the institutional knowledge.
It's a great argument.
It's an argument against term limits, is it?
Well, that's not for me to say. you're putting me on the spot there. That's not for me to say, but it just shows that they happen no matter what.
All right, finally, SportsIllustrated.com reported this week that Indianapolis Colts quarterback Peyton Manning had a fourth neck operation. The report says the procedure happened sometime last summer between a second surgery for his bulging disc and the cervical neck fusion. It also reports that he's developed bone spurs, which could lead to another procedure. The Colts and Manning's agent declined to comment on the report as Manning and Colts owner Jim Irsay prepare to renegotiate his contract. Mike McDaniel, can you believe all the drama coming out of the Colts complex right
now? Yes. Peyton Manning has been the face of the NFL, not just of the Indianapolis Colts for the last, better part of the last decade. People love him here, and for good reason. He has brought more victories to this franchise than anyone in the NFL or last decade. So it's easy to see why people would care as much as they do about
it. Is that the best soap opera in town?
I don't think they're going to sit down to negotiate. I think Jim Irsay is negotiating right now in the media.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely true.
And I think to echo what Mike said, you know, some people may not want their lawmakers and representatives to serve for decades, but they do want their quarterback to serve for decades if he possibly can.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Leslie Weidenbender of the StateHouseFile.com. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Week in Review under News. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.